Today is Thursday, November 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, hip-hop artist Jay-Z is helping sue the U.S. state of Mississippi over conditions of prisons.
These prisons are not safe for anyone.
Plus, protests and arrests in Canada over a pipeline on Indigenous territory. And the latest on the COVID-19 coronavirus outbreak. Those stories and more are next. The head of the World Health Organization said Thursday it would be a, quote, fatal mistake, end quote, for any country to assume it will not be hit by the new coronavirus. WHO Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus also said that rich countries that might have thought they were safer should expect surprises. He also said the COVID-19 outbreak is at a, quote, decisive moment, end quote, as countries race to prepare. Saudi Arabia on Thursday banned foreign pilgrims from entering the kingdom to visit Islam's holiest sites over the new coronavirus, potentially disrupting the plans of millions of faithful ahead of the fasting month of Ramadan and the annual Hajj pilgrimage. Meanwhile, Iran confirms that infected cases in the country spiked by over 100 to 254. Those with the virus in Iran now include Iranian Vice President. A total of 26 people have died so far in the country, the world's highest death toll outside China, where the outbreak began. The global count of those sickened by the virus hovered around 82,000, with 433 new cases reported Thursday in China and 505 more in South Korea, where the military called off joint drills planned with American troops. And as the number of COVID-19 cases continues to jump in South Korea, the spread of the virus is having an effect on diplomatic and defense issues related to North Korea. VOA's Seoul correspondent Bill Gallo briefed my colleague Kate Pound Dawson on the latest.
Well, as of about 1 week ago, there were only around 30 to 50 infections, confirmed infections of the coronavirus in South Korea. As of today, that number has shot up to 1,766. Today was actually the biggest daily increase yet. We saw over 500 new confirmed infections. This is shooting up rapidly. It's in part because South Korea is very technologically advanced. They're very proactive at testing. They've tested a lot of people, therefore they have a lot more confirmed cases. However, this is creating a sense of worry. I wouldn't say panic, but a sense of widespread worry in South Korea. And it's obviously worse in the southeastern region near Daegu, the fourth largest city, but it is starting to spread in many different parts of the country, and it seems only a matter of time before it will be in every region of the country.
Now, how is this affecting the relationship between North Korea and South Korea? North Korea so far has said it does not have any infections. And at the same time, there's been an effort to build a different, better relationship between the South and the North, as well as the U.S. effort to negotiate on North Korea's nuclear weapons. How does this factor into the mix?
Well, the immediate result on the nuclear talks is that they have just been absolutely slammed shut. North Korea has essentially walled itself in from the outside world. They've prevented any international tourists from coming. Yeah, so they've attempted to close their border with China. What we are hearing from sources here in South Korea is that it has been weeks since North Korean officials have been able to actually get out and meet their counterparts, whether that's the U.S. counterparts or European counterparts. They've essentially walled themselves in. So these talks have gone nowhere. But the interesting thing is that the U.S. and South Korea were actually forced to postpone indefinitely their military exercises that were planned to start next week. The result of that is that there may be fewer tensions between the U.S. and North Korea. These military exercises, of course, were the source of great frustration by North Korea. Every year when these happen, they usually make a big racket and do something in response, whether that's test a missile or have their own exercises. That apparently will not happen now, but that doesn't mean that everything's okay, because North Korea obviously is very worried about this infection spreading within its own borders.
Well, you mentioned the U.S. forces there in South Korea. We do know that there is one U.S. service member who has been affected. How is the coronavirus affecting the U.S. military operations and life for the U.S. military there? There's about 28,000 troops plus some family members, civilian employees.
There is great concern that this has reached the U.S. military here in South Korea. So far, it only has infected one service member. Two other people who are linked to U.S. bases here have been infected. But the fact that this virus is so highly contagious, and the fact that you have lots of people living close together on U.S. military bases, sharing communal housing, sharing meals, this is a situation that is possibly easy for a virus like this to spread, so there is great concern. You've seen a lot of restrictions as far as who is allowed to access the base, who is allowed to leave the base. A lot of businesses, entertainment sites, and things like this on U.S. military bases have either been closed or restricted.
That was VOA's correspondent in Seoul, Bill Gallo, speaking with editor Kate Pound Dawson. Now, President Donald Trump of the U.S. held a news conference on the U.S.'s preparations for the possible spread of the novel coronavirus in that country. Among other items, he named Vice President Mike Pence the head of the federal response. Trump had a confident message for Americans, but there are some criticism of his administration's efforts so far. For more, we go live to VOA's Patsy Wodakuswara at the White House. Hello, Patsy. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
So Trump has been quite confident, the amount of money that is being allocated by the federal government is lower than what some Democrats and some others would like to see. And this in some ways goes against what even the World Health Organization says, which is that even wealthy countries need to really take this as seriously as possible. Does Trump's confidence reflect the reality?
Well, that's the thing that everybody's talking about today after this very rare appearance by the president. This is only his second appearance in the briefing room yesterday in his entire time in office. So that shows, it symbolizes how seriously he takes this issue, at least the optics of how he's handling it. After the day before, he was accusing the media of creating panic and tanking the stock market. So, yes, there was a huge push from the Trump administration, from the president himself, to reassure Americans that his administration has it under control. There's a lot of downplaying that he said. You know, he said that because of all that we've done, the risk to American people remains very low, and there's a chance that it won't spread. Now, these things are actually contradictory to what his own officials on the same stage at the same time are saying. For example, when we said that we'll essentially have a flu shot for this, meaning a vaccine, in a fairly quick manner, a few minutes after that, Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, said that it would take at least 2 months to determine whether a vaccine is safe, and then another 8 months to conduct a larger study to see if it works. So, you know, time frame of at least close to a year. The other thing that was being questioned by journalists, including myself, we were able to ask questions to the president. And so I asked him the question, why is the U.S. only testing under 500 people so far and only those who have traveled to China despite the global spread of the virus? And I asked the president whether he's planning to test more people. And he said that we're testing everybody that we need to test and we're finding very little problem. And then he goes on to say that we should treat this the way we treat the flu, wash your hands a lot, stay indoors when you're not feeling well, and so on. So there's a lot of criticism about how the president is handling this. But yes, you're right. The administration is asking $2.5 billion from Congress for additional funding.
Now, one thing that he did announce was that Vice President Mike Pence would lead the federal response. Of course, Pence really doesn't have any medical background. And in fact, he's been criticized for his handling of an HIV outbreak in his in the state of Indiana when he was governor there. Is he up to the task?
Yes, that's another thing that we questioned was that, you know, what is Vice President Mike Pence's experience in handling the crisis? And we also questioned the fact that the White House has been for 2 days pushing reports that they were considering of appointing a coronavirus czar to handle this. And yesterday at the briefing, the president announced that he's appointing Mike Pence to be the lead person into this, replacing Alex Azar, the HHS secretary. And this morning, Mike Pence has just announced Ambassador Debbie Birx to serve as the coronavirus response coordinator. So Ambassador Birx is currently the State Department coordinator of to combat HIV/AIDS and also special representative for global health diplomacy. So there's a lot of people doing double or triple roles in this administration. So that's also coming into question as to how prepared the administration is to deal with this.
Got it. That was VOA's Patsy Wadakuswara at the White House. Thank you so much for joining us, Patsy.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Accused the U.S. government commission of politicizing communal violence in New Delhi that killed at least 30 people and injured more than 200 as President Donald Trump was visiting the country earlier this week. On Wednesday, the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom said it was deeply troubled by the violence and cited accounts that police had not intervened in attacks against Muslims. Germany's highest court on Thursday upheld a ban against a Muslim legal trainee who was wearing a headscarf while performing certain official tasks. In a 7-1 decision, the Federal Constitutional Court said that while the ban does interfere with the woman's freedom of religion, it is justified in order to uphold a law that calls for, quote, neutral conduct, end quote, by legal trainees when it comes to ideological and religious matters. And Turkey-backed Syrian opposition fighters retook a strategic northwestern town from government forces on Thursday. That's according to opposition activists. That cuts off a key highway, which just days after the government had reopened it for the first time since 2012. Despite losing the town, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's forces have made major gains in the south. He now controls almost the entire southern part of Idlib province after capturing more than 20 villages Thursday. That's according to state media and opposition activists. You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A number of studies have previously linked the consumption of sugary drinks with increased risks of death from a wide range of causes. A new study published in the Journal of the American Heart Association provides evidence that drinking around 355 milliliters of sugary drinks more than once a day is connected to a couple of factors that can contribute to cardiovascular disease. The study finds that among middle-aged to older adults, drinking sugar-sweetened beverages can lower levels of HDL or good cholesterol, which helps remove bad cholesterol from the bloodstream, while increasing levels of triglycerides, another type of fat found in the blood. The study also shows that drinking low-calorie sweetened beverages or up to 355 milliliters of 100% fruit juice every day wasn't associated with increased risks or adverse effects of elevated fats and cholesterol in the bloodstream. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Hip-hop artist Jay-Z is backing a new lawsuit representing more than 150 inmates in the Mississippi prison system, who say the state's notorious Parchman Prison is a violent place where inmates live in, quote, abhorrent conditions, end quote. 19 inmates have died in the southern U.S. state's prisons in the last 2 months, including a 36-year-old who died Wednesday. To find out more about what's going on, earlier I spoke to Joe Neff, a reporter for the Marshall Project, which investigates conditions in American prisons.
Well, the problems in the Mississippi prison system have been long in coming. There's not enough prison guards to guard the inmates. Last year, we got to a point where you would have one correctional officer at Parchman watching maybe 150 inmates in a dorm. Oftentimes the guard is a woman in charge of keeping control of 150 men. And another issue is that the prisons have always been dangerous, and there's a lot of gang members in prison. You go to prison, you join a gang because you need protection. So you put those two together, a lot of prison gang members and very little supervision, it's like a pressure cooker. The only way that the guards can maintain control is just to keep everyone locked up all the time. And then you have inmates inside of their cells or dorms who are just don't get out of the cell to take a shower, to go outside and breathe fresh air, to go to church or school. The conditions are so bad that I talked to a number of correctional officers who've been severely injured at these prisons, that they are scared out of their minds. These prisons are not safe for anyone.
In the last 2 months, there have been, across the Mississippi prison system, 19 different inmates have died. What is causing this really concerning outbreak of inmates dying?
The killings, many of them were between rival gangs that just pressure has been festering. Some of them have been suicides, and there is very, very poor mental health care in the prisons in Mississippi. And some are, the prison officials say, well, the person died of natural causes. I believe that there are some drug overdoses in there. Medical care is really poor. For an inmate to get actually out of their cell, out of their block, and over to the clinic can be almost an insurmountable obstacle. One of the prisons in southern Mississippi in 2018, the prison had to cancel 70% of scheduled medical visits because they didn't have enough guards to escort the inmates from their cell out to the clinic, which is maybe just a couple hundred feet away. I've talked to people who work at Parchman who said they were in a kitchen facility when a sewer broke, and pretty soon they're ankle deep in sewage with feces bobbing around. And this is in a facility where they're making food. The roofs leak. The water facilities are terrible. Mold is everywhere. They are really in a state of disrepair.
What can be done about this? On the one hand, it seems like one solution could be hiring more guards.
I don't think anyone's advocating that they expand the number of guards. Part of the solution is just to fill all the vacancies that are there. Another thing is just that to how many people in prison actually need to be there. Mississippi has some laws which activists criticize as being too punitive, 15 years for marijuana conviction. One of the things that the state needs to do is, do all these people need to be there? Many of them don't.
For Americans, when we think of particularly a facility like Parchman Prison, it has a notorious history. And can you talk a bit about those connections between the very problematic history in the American South and how that's related to the crisis of the prisons today?
Parchman is located in the middle of the Mississippi Delta, a huge place to grow cotton. Slaves grew the cotton. Before the Civil War, after the Civil War, farmers would lease convicts to work their farms under brutal conditions. And Parchman, which is an 18,000-acre farm, was started in the early part of the 1900s, and it's been this place where largely black incarcerated population would work the farm and grow food, and for a long time it was a moneymaker for the state budget. So Parchman is an icon of racism and incarceration and subjugation in the South. There have been some lawsuits back in the 70s, 80s, and later trying to improve the horrible conditions there. The past 5 years, it's just been slowly deteriorating into now it's unfathomable to think about being an inmate in that Unit 29.
Canadian police have arrested dozens of people in recent days who were protesting the construction of a natural gas pipeline on traditional land of the Wet'suwet'en tribe in Canada's British Columbian province. Supporters of the indigenous group have blocked major streets, railways, and ports around the country, demanding police trying to open the way for the pipeline to stand down. On Thursday, a leader of the Wet'suwet'en tribe, whose lands the pipeline would run through, said he would meet with Canadian authorities, the Globe and Mail newspaper reported. For more, I spoke to journalist Anna Roach, who has been covering the protests from Toronto.
There's going to be an attempted negotiation on the side of the government to remove blockades throughout the country and on the side of the Wet'suwet'en to pull police force out of the territory. But at this point, the hereditary chiefs have met with other government officials quite a few times, and they've been trying to meet with government officials for years about this. And so far, they have found that negotiations have been unsuccessful and unproductive, and that the compromises that the government was willing to make were not sufficient for them to stand by. When RCMP offered to withdraw, they offered to withdraw if the blockade on Wet'suwet'en territory was dismantled. And now what has happened is that, so there's a particularly, acrimonious blockade in Tandanega, in Ontario, between Toronto and Montreal. Since Trudeau has announced that all the blockades must come down, that blockade was raided. It was a pretty large contingent of the police. They made 10 arrests, and that really triggered a whole new wave of blockades throughout the country. There was a big blockade in Toronto where there were a bunch of arrests. There was that big blockade in Vancouver. There was stuff in, like, Hamilton, kind of all over the country. Wet'suwet'en people, they and other Indigenous people throughout Canada have, like, consistently throughout history experienced, like, militarized police coming through and taking their land, and that's what they see is happening right now. They see that police are trying to come into their territory unauthorized and armed to make way for a pipeline.
One of the demands has been for the Wet'suwet'en to tell their supporters to stand down, to tell others to stop protesting on their behalf, to stop blockading railways, to stop blockading ports and roads and other things. And this is something that the Wet'suwet'en has refused to do. And why is that?
Well, that's because over throughout the history of Canada existing as a country, there have been a million negotiations with Indigenous peoples that have not really been abided by when there were agreements. And I think that the blockades that are happening right now are kind of the only assurance that they have that negotiations might actually happen. And so they don't want the blockades to go down before negotiations, because if that happens, then the government doesn't necessarily have incentives to try and address the situation.
Now, you're in Toronto, and there have been some protests in Toronto that you've been attending, and you've been speaking to numerous activists. What is their feeling like right now? What are they saying right now, and what's their attitude about the latest?
What we're seeing right now is Indigenous folks are proclaiming that reconciliation is dead, and that's really historic. Because up until now, the language of reconciliation, meaning that it's a new era of history where, like, the Canadian government is now going to try and reconcile and make things right, that idea was kind of brought about in the 90s. And a lot of Indigenous people grew up believing in it and grew up believing that the government was going to try to make things right. And so I think for a lot of the young Indigenous people who are becoming political today, recently there's been kind of a turning point where it's like, no, we no longer believe that the Canadian government is trying to reconcile. So the idea that reconciliation is dead is a new one, and that is historic for Canada.
That was journalist Anna Roach in Toronto, Canada, speaking to me earlier today. The United Nations says Rohingya Muslims and other minorities in Myanmar are experiencing an upsurge in violations and abuse fueled by prejudice and hate speech. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights submitted a report on the root causes of abuse in Myanmar to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva that UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet says that laws and policies promoting discrimination and exclusion against religious and ethnic minorities in Myanmar have existed for more than half a century. Notably, the UN Human Rights Chief said, quote, the 1982 citizenship law rendered stateless a significant proportion of the Rohingya and other Muslims, end quote. Oppression of the stateless Muslim minority peaked in August 2017. That was when violence and persecution, reported killings and rape by the Myanmar military, triggered a mass exodus of more than 700,000 Rohingya to Bangladesh. Bachelet said other ethnic and religious minorities across Myanmar also suffer serious human rights violations at the hands of the military. She says their counterinsurgency policies and tactics at times have deliberately targeted civilians. Bachelet urged the government to de-escalate xenophobic, discriminatory practices and to promote interfaith and interethnic tolerance. But Myanmar's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Kyaw Moe Tun, says his government's efforts to achieve national reconciliation and peace with ethnic armed groups are advancing. But he adds transforming the country from authoritarian rule to a democratic federal union takes time. That's it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our engineer, Patrick Dea, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening, and have a great evening.